This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jonathan Cunningham and John Gossier don't seem to have all that much in common. John followed his wife to Uganda in 2008 with no steady plan for work. He's a software developer by trade. He met lots of Ugandans with raw talent in that field. They were just missing experience. So John founded Apfrica, a company that helps create jobs, host workshops, and provide other opportunities for the budding software entrepreneurs of East Africa. Jonathan Cunningham has a different story. He was a Marine. In 2005, he lost most of his right arm when his patrol was ambushed near the Euphrates River in Iraq. Jonathan ended up with a prosthetic arm, like many other wounded military men. But he has an engineering background, and he wanted to help make a better prosthesis, so he helped to create the Open Prosthetics Project. It posts research on prosthetic hardware on the internet so that others can use it for free. What John and Jonathan do have in common is TED. It's a nonprofit that mixes together thinkers in technology, entertainment, and design. Its goal, to spread worthwhile ideas. John and Jonathan are going to be speaking in Chapel Hill tomorrow at the TEDx event called Global Health. What's technology got to do with it? First, they're here with us in the studio. John, Jonathan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
So, John, let me start with your story. John Gossier, you were talking about Apfrica.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us about that, what it does, and how you came to found that company.
Sure. So I started Apfrica in 2008. The idea was to build local capacity to do high-tech work in the region instead of flying consultants in to do these types of projects for NGOs and multinationals who are doing work in the region. There's a very well-trained body of talent there. They just sort of lack experience. And so I started this as a hub to get people involved. And since then, I sort of moved on. I still run that project, but got involved with another project called Ushahidi, which makes open source software for crowdsourcing during disaster scenarios.
So tell us a little bit about the development of both of these. First of all, with Apfrica and then the crowdsourcing stuff. What is it that you focus on in particular in that region in East Africa?
Sure. Well, I think the two are actually really interesting because Ushahidi represents a local African tech innovation that's now used globally during disaster scenarios, most recently during Japan. And the Apfrica side of things is just building that talent and nurturing it and helping it get to the next level. And so with Ushahidi, we focus on real-time response during global events. So the immediacy of the crowd is really hard to beat during scenarios where we lack information, we lack awareness about what's going on. People can use their mobile phones. They can SMS to send text messages to whoever set up the software. Those people then receive that information, and then groups like IntraHealth, UN, the Red Cross, they can respond to the citizens who are seeking help.
So this is a kind of – so this would be a website that would aggregate these messages, and I would go and say, what's going on? And where.
Exactly. And particularly the where is really important to us. So geolocating these SMS mm-hmm. messages was a huge innovation for us.
When you talk about developing the talent, and you said you found lots of talent there, it just didn't have there wasn't the experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're led to believe that you need all kinds of education, you need to develop this, and that education infrastructure in some parts of the world is the thing that's lacking. Can you start at this level, start by developing software technology, or do you have to go from the ground up?
You don't always have to go from the ground up. So there's sort of two – I have sort of two perspectives on this. One is that if people are learning by doing, if they're learning beside someone who is an expert or has more expertise than they do, they pick up things really quickly. I think the real key is to find people who are motivated to learn and to sort of persevere when things get difficult. So when I was in Kampala, I would work with guys who had gone to school or who were in school, and they were finding it difficult, even with the best education their country could offer, to find jobs and to do the things they wanted to do. So I think that was a real enabler for the types of sort of high-tech software projects that we were doing. you can start from zero. It's just more difficult because you spend more time on the building blocks as opposed to doing things.
Well, it's also interesting because you're working with the platforms that are already in everybody's hands.
Exactly.
Texting and SMS is very big. And
it's so pervasive throughout Africa.
So start there. And then the other thing it seems to me you're doing is keeping those well-educated, well-trained people right there where they can make a job. Because as you suggest, if there's no job for me and I'm good, I'm leaving.
Exactly. And I think that's really important for the country or the countries around the world who have this problem. If you're training your best resources and they're going off to work at, everywhere around the world except your country, that's a drain on state resources. It's a drain on the local public's resources. So,
and of course, then you read that the other way as a policymaker. You say, well, why am I going to do that if I'm sending them to somewhere else?
Exactly.
So that's an impediment to developing education infrastructure.
Yeah,
to schools, right?
It's a huge impediment to dedicating resources and actually building up the sector, because they then know what's going to happen afterwards.
And crowdsourcing, let's get back to that, because you have a feeling that in effect we are moving back to an ancient, an old way of gathering information and telling stories in a way.
Yeah, so I think what this is sort of the next level of crowdsourcing is this concept of local authorities. So if you look back to pre-printing press days, the way most societies got information about their cultures was through the local authority, the church, the shaman, whoever that local authority was. And I think what's happening on the web is people are creating, whether it's explicitly or inadvertently, these sort of filter bubbles. There's a great book that just came out about this by Eli Pariser called Filter Bubbles, where you are creating a digital reflection of a worldview that you might already have and nothing else permeates. Mm-hmm. So you get really radical beliefs and they may not be so in touch with reality. And so that localization is now not geospatial, but it's in ideology and sameness of
right.
thought.
So that's one of the other really important reasons for developing this on the ground in the region where it's going to be used.
Because
that becomes a reflection of us, of who we are.
Exactly. It's also teaching people about ways of consuming data, and you can sort of preempt that inadvertent bubble by empowering people to understand why it's important to have sort of outside voices and why it's important to contribute to communities that may not share the same thought.
And at the same time, it doesn't necessarily stay there. As you suggested, this technology, once it gets out, becomes the model for a global invention, global idea that is actually rooted perhaps in East Africa in this case.
Absolutely. Ushahidi being a great example, the local banking software, M-Pesa being another, this innovation that was developed in Africa sort of trickling up and going worldwide.
This is a thing that's pretty much, it's not necessarily unique to Kenya, but it's kind of ground zero for cell phone banking that allows people in the field and in rural areas to have access to money.
Yeah, and that's it's a huge time saver. It's more efficient for people there. So if they can do payroll via SMS, then that saves. I mean, I used to spend hours going to the bank in Kampala, and sort of on the cusp of mobile banking sort of spreading throughout the region. And now, you don't even have to do that. It's just all electronics.
All right there on your iPhone. Just hang on to it. Yeah. Jonathan, let's talk about your story now. Tell us about the Open Prosthetics Project, how it came about.
I was a graduate student at Duke University and in my spare time in a design firm in Durham, North Carolina. And after I was hurt in Iraq as a mechanical and biomedical engineer, I began to think that I had enormous number of ideas of how this particular area of technology, prosthetic arms, might be improved. What I didn't realize was that the real reason for the lack of innovation in the space had nothing to do with a lack of good ideas. It had more to do with our ability as a society to do anything with those ideas. And so after I excitedly went to my partners and said, we're going to get rich doing this because this, you would not believe how, scarce innovation is in this area. My friend Kevin Webb said, we all agreed after looking at it that there was just no way a good model, a good business model for entering the space. And Kevin said, well, look, you know, clearly you're going to have these ideas. What if we thought about it like in the same way that an open source software project is thought about, you know, that you can scratch your itch and come up with ideas and then share them with others. And so the basic idea is that the Open Prosthetics Project is a fluid network of information exchange around this niche area. So we're local in a different way that John's customers are local. We're not geographically local. We're a locality of underserved need interest.
But underserved because the demand is not great enough to generate the kind of research and development and then bring the product to market.
Exactly.
That it would require, the kind of money it would require. So you do it online and it becomes an open source project. But first talk about the innovation, because I keep seeing all of these sort of miracle stories about prosthetics and hooking it up to the brain and allowing, you know, these sort of bionic parts that are, you know, and I see these things all the time. But you're saying, really, we're not quite there yet.
Well, I have to be careful exactly how I say this, just because, you know, I have a friend who's been in research in this area for decades, and he says, you know, he always gets upset. He says, look, I'm tired of hearing everybody say that nothing's happened in prosthetics in 30 years. And it is true, you know, in the strictest sense that plenty has happened, although the things that have happened have been science projects in the pejorative sense, you know, in that they have not made it to the clinic. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would like to hold us in the research industry to the highest standard and say that, you know, until we actually get something on somebody's arm, until I can go over to the VA across town and say, I want this product, until I can get something different, we haven't really accomplished anything. I think we have to hold ourselves to that standard. So what I say is that we have a media bias, and it's not a political bias, which is what most of my either very conservative or very liberal friends would say. It's an entertainment bias, and people like good stories. And good stories are usually disasters or celebrations. And I think that the real story is probably somewhere in the middle. And you know, the problem is it doesn't fit in a soundbite.
So how does the open source model help that?
Well, you know, I think that it surprised me a little bit. You know, initially I thought, well, we're going to create this fluid network for the exchange of ideas. And, you know, in the same way that maybe the assumption has been that government research, if they create an innovation, that it'll then be able to cross what we call the valley of death and reach market. You know, my assumption had been, well, we just need to make a few more connections and make the information more available, and that'll be enough to create that activation energy to make something happen. And I think that that's been, you know, even slower than I expected that it would be. But in a lot of ways, people's interest has been piqued by the nature, by the mechanism. I mean, people are excited about free. People want to give away their ideas and their time and help. And I would say the surprising thing that we've accomplished is not, you know, that we've created a good idea that's become a product, but that we have created a locality and a fluid network for information so that more discussion has taken place around the topic. And so, you know, just an example that I would throw out there is discussion on our websites about osseointegration, which is a risky medical procedure where they put a bolt in your bone that exits your skin and it has a secure attachment to your skeleton. And it's, you know, it's risky, it's experimental, it's not approved in the United States, but there are patients who are passionate about it. And, you know, until we had this blow up on the Open Prosthetics Project social network with everybody discussing this, there was not all that much information available about it.
So, but apart from discussion, there are people who are doing research and putting it out there for others to – putting it out there free. So it's not
there
proprietary.
Are.
Now, who are these people who want to give away their research? Who are they?
Well, you know, it's worth backing up probably and remembering that – you know, except for maybe the last decade, you know, the tradition has been in scientific research that we are all giving it away. I mean, scientific publishing is giving away your ideas, but it's, you know, making sure that you take credit for it and receive credit in a public forum. And it's only really recently that academics, because of the Bayh-Dole Act and the change in the way government-funded intellectual property has happened, the idea that you can both be a respected academic and make a fortune in a private company at the same time has really happened. And so I would argue that it's not a new thing at all.
And the research is out there. And the fact is that we talked about the market itself being small. We know that there are a number of service personnel coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Sadly, isn't the market growing? Isn't there a big market? And isn't the government involved in this?
It is growing, but perhaps not as quickly as people might think.
How many people do we know who have lost limbs and could benefit by this research in the military?
So we have fewer than 2,000 amputees total, U.S. service members from Iraq and Afghanistan, and of those, something on the order of 250 are arm amputees, and there are many who are multiples, and unfortunately, in very recent. There was an article in the New York Times a couple of days ago about the incredible rise among Marines in multiple limb amputations and polytrauma. Demographically, there are also TBI or traumatic brain injury patients, PTSD, spinal cord injuries, limb salvage patients who may or may not eventually end up being amputees. So I think that the media focus on amputees, it may not necessarily be proportional to the numbers. And we are, in some ways we're fortunate that we're a very small number, but in other ways, not so fortunate because the real truth is that we aren't creating a market that doesn't now exist for prosthetic arms or legs. I mean, the only real significant market in the United States for prosthetics is for legs because we have, something like 2.3 million leg amputees, most of whom are diabetics with peripheral vascular disease.
John, tell us a little bit about TEDx and its relationship to TED and what's going to happen in Chapel Hill.
Sure. So TED, as you mentioned, is this group that started, I think, over 20 years ago, doing these sort of scientific talks, and then it sort of spun off to be this bigger thing. Now gets over 290 million views annually. And so TEDx was their way of sort of like democratizing that access. TED's a very exclusive, expensive event. Guys like Al Gore, Bill Gates have given great TED Talks, but not everyone can go. So they first tried to open this up by giving away the videos, and then they when that opened it up some, but they wanted to open it up even more so that everyone could get the experience of going to such an event where you could think, where you could imagine, where you could share ideas. And so TEDx is sort of like that extension of their brand. And it's sort of taken off. It happens, I think there's maybe 10 going on tomorrow alone, but the one that's going on here is focused on global health, and it's got some great speakers, Josh Nesbitt from Medic Mobile, Robert Malcolm from Duke University, Radhika Chakrabarti of Sana, and both Jonathan and myself will be there as well. So yeah, I think it's going to be a great event.
Sounds great. Thanks for the preview.
Yeah.
Good to talk with you both.
Thanks
very much for having us.
Talking today with John Gossier, the founder of AfriCup, a company that invests in software startups in East Africa. Jonathan Cunningham is an engineer and one of the founders of Open Prosthetics Project. It posts research on prosthetic hardware designed to the internet so that others can access it for free. Both of them are going to speak tomorrow at TEDx. It's called Global Health, What's Technology Got to Do With It? Program starts at 6 p.m., Varsity Theater, downtown Chapel Hill. You can go to TEDxChapelHill.com for more information. The State of Things continues in a moment. Stay with us.